Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I am very glad you're here with me today. I love doing this podcast. I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, OmkariWilliams.com. In this time of COVID-19, we are regularly treated to the spectacle of the President of the United States describing the disease in racist terms aimed at blaming the disease on its country of origin. Besides being juvenile and hateful, this has the result of putting those of Asian descent in the crosshairs of unhinged racists around the United States. When we speak of racism in the U.S., we tend to think in terms of anti-Black racism. But Black people are not alone in experiencing racism here. And my guest today takes on racism directed at another minority. Grace Pye is the director of organizing at Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. She has spent the last 6 years organizing in Chicago and training hundreds of organizers and community leaders across the country. Building political power is one of her passions, and Grace recently led the effort to launch Asian American Midwest Progressives, a political organization that endorses progressive candidates for elective office. I am so happy to welcome Grace to the podcast. Hi, Grace.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm really pleased. This is such an important conversation right now with all of the insanity that's happening in the world. So I actually want to start with a question for you because that I think a lot of people have. When people talk about Asian American communities, I think that there's a lot of confusion about that. And it's something I particularly noticed in the wake of Kamala Harris being nominated to be vice president on Biden's ticket. So if you could talk about what Asian communities actually encompasses, Asian American communities, who are the people that actually encompass?
Absolutely. That's a great question because the Asian American community is so diverse. It encompasses so many different ethnic communities and backgrounds that I think it is kind of cast in a more monolithic way in the dominant narrative and kind of in the general public discourse. And so Asian American communities, there's kind of three broad categories. I would say there are East Asians, South Asians, and Southeast Asians. And so East Asians are folks who, you know, have come from China, Korea, Japan, that kind of region of East Asia. South Asia comprises of India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Southeast Asia is the region encompassing like Vietnam, Laos, Thailand. And, you know, those regions, you know, I mean, just throughout history have had very different relationships with each other. There has been a lot of colonization and imperialism within Asia that impacts the way that Asian Americans in the U.S. interact with each other and that different ethnic communities interact with each other. And even within single countries, I mean, there's such a diversity of languages spoken, of religions practiced, that there is just a lot of depth when it comes to our community. And, you know, people kind of think of an Asian American person as an East Asian person, and that erases a lot of the experiences of people who are Southeast Asian or South Asian. And there's this kind of stereotype, right, of what an Asian American person looks like that doesn't capture the realities of many communities and people.
It's interesting that you say that because I had the opportunity to spend time in Vietnam a few years ago, and I went from South Vietnam to North Vietnam. And Vietnam is a very long, narrow country. And one of the things that absolutely struck me was not only how different the cultures were from South to North, but that people actually looked different and that the language was different to my very uneducated ear, but I could hear the differences in the language. And it just really brought home to me how important it is not to look at these places as monolithic, because even within one country, the distinctions are quite dramatic.
Absolutely. Well, and I think that particular example of Vietnam is also so influenced by the Vietnam War, right? And the US's involvement in shaping just the politics and future of that country. My family is Korean American. And, you know, when my grandfather was born, he lived in a unified Korea. Thinking about the role that the US played and in the division of Korea too, there are just so many implications of, you know, not just the US, but of many different kind of global powers meddling in other countries. I think, you know, my grandfather, he said he couldn't even fathom the idea that Korea could be two countries when he was growing up, right? That would have sounded just preposterous. And I mean, you know, he grew up under the Japanese occupation of Korea. And so he lived through a very difficult time. But, you know, even despite that, he didn't, you know, think it was possible that there would be a North Korea and a South Korea. And so I think, you know, in a similar way, Vietnam has just experienced so much of that just difficulty of being a target of like imperialist forces.
Yeah. And you can still see the impacts of it in the society these decades later. And it really makes one take a step back and look at things through a broader lens and understand that the implications of our actions often go far beyond what we think they're going to be. And it certainly makes me think about being more careful in how I engage in the world and the unintended consequences of things that we do. So it was quite an education. And I wish I could go back because it's beautiful, but there's no traveling anywhere if you're American right now. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. One day we'll be able to do that and to learn, right? I think just going through the world with that goal of learning and being open-minded is just so important because, you know, there was a lot that I didn't know about the Asian American community that I have learned since organizing with Asian Americans and being more deeply committed to building relationships in that space as an Asian American person, you know, and as someone who grew up in a community with lots of Asian Americans. It's just not history that we get taught in school. And they're not stories that are valued or prioritized in our education system or in media. And so, you know, I think seeking out those opportunities is really important.
I agree. I have a question though. So as you were describing the different communities that make up the Asian American community in the United States, I'm wondering where Pacific Islanders fit in. Are they considered part of the Asian American community?
Yeah, so one
of the,
is that
separate?
Yeah, well, one of the kind of broad terms that is used these days is AAPI, Asian American and Pacific Islander. There are many terms, right? So that is just one. And, you know, I talk about Asian Americans a little bit separately from Pacific Islanders because I feel like I don't have that much insight into the Pacific Islander community. And so I don't want to claim to represent a community that I really don't have much of a grounding in at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, another common term is AANHPI, Asian American and Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. And so I think, you know, broadly speaking, in terms of kind of racial categories in the US, I would say that Pacific Islanders are part of that broader, you know, Asian American and Pacific Islander grouping. But again, it just speaks to the diversity of experiences. Like Asian American is such a broad term and it, you know, often is used to kind of paint communities that have very different experiences with the same brush. And so the more that we can both disaggregate data and look for data that is more specific to distinct communities to better understand them. I think that's a really critical part of, you know, not just understanding communities, but also policymaking that impacts so many different communities. Like when you look at income of AAPIs in the US, Asians as a racial group have the largest gap between rich Asian Americans and poor Asian Americans. Like that racial wealth gap is the largest in the Asian American community as compared to any other racial group in the United States, which if you asked anybody on the street if they thought that that was true, I'm guessing that most people would say, no way, like that can't be true. Like Asian Americans are well off. There can't be this huge gap. But it's because of that lack of understanding that there are many different ways that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders came to the U.S. Like lots of Asian Americans came as refugees, and that has had a profound impact on even just like their earnings or, you know, their ability to access resources in their communities.
I am one of those people who would not have thought that was true. So just raising my hand over here, it's like, no, I did not know that that disparity was the greatest in the Asian American community. I honestly, I don't think it would have even occurred to me to put Asian Americans on that chart of where those disparities exist. So that's a really interesting thing to just become aware of. And I know that one of the things that Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago has worked on hard is to bring together the Asian American community, because as you say, it is not a monolith, obviously not a monolith. What are some of the specific challenges that you have faced in that effort?
Yeah, you know, I think one big challenge is just that Asian American, it is a political identity. So it's not an identity that people necessarily grow up or even as adults personally identify with. A lot of Asian Americans identify more with their ethnic identities, you know, as like Korean American or Indian American or Vietnamese American, rather than as, you know, this kind of pan-Asian umbrella identity. Mm-hmm. And so I think for that reason, you know, a lot of the even organizations that have developed to provide resources or to engage those communities have done that more on a kind of ethnicity by ethnicity basis. And so we see in Chicago a really vibrant array of organizations like social service organizations and community-based organizations, groups that do community organizing, but they're kind of separated by these different ethnic communities. One way that we've, you know, brought organizations together is by convening a coalition called the Pan-Asian Voter Empowerment Coalition that was actually formed in 2010 around efforts to increase involvement in the census in 2010 in the AAPI community. And, you know, since everybody was working on the census, we came together and said, all right, how can we support each other figuring out how best to reach our communities? Because many of the barriers are similar across our communities. There are language barriers, right? There's limited access to healthcare or mistrust of, you know, a census enumerator knocking on your door or lack of understanding of a mailing that you might get from the government. And so, you know, we came together to jointly strategize and to support each other and have continued to do work kind of as that Pan-Asian coalition ever since.
That's really interesting, because I think that because we here in the United States do tend to think of Asian Americans in monolithic terms, that we don't really consider the historical and language and cultural barriers that would keep the Asian American community separate from itself. So actually looking at it as a political designation really helps me in terms of thinking about how do you want to engage with people, because it's not about culture right now in that way. It's about what are the overarching issues that you as a group of people from a similar place on the planet, even though very different cultures face? How can we engage together? And I find that quite an interesting way of thinking of it and sort of tweaking that tendency to look at Asian Americans in monolithic terms.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely our approach. You know, we're looking for the commonality in experience across these identities that may feel different to people on the ground. And honestly, you know, it's the same kind of approach when we're talking about doing cross-racial organizing, that we're looking for commonality and experience, right? To say you have much more in common with someone from, you know, another racial group than you might think. And we just have to ask those questions and start those conversations to start to build that possibility for solidarity work, right? And to fight for each other, because we're so much more powerful when we're working together than we are when we're working in our separate silos.
That actually brings me to something that I wanted to ask you about, which is there is a real problem with racism within the AAPI community, including anti-Black racism. And then it goes both ways, obviously. It's not a one-way street. And I always find that kind of odd. I feel like, wait, we're all in the same leaky boat. Can we not figure out how to make this work as a group? But I'm curious about some of the challenges that you face with anti-Black racism within the AAPI community.
It's definitely a big problem and one that is widespread. And, you know, I mean, I think it's certainly a product of being Asian Americans, right? The piece of being in America is, I think, important to that anti-Black racism. It's, you know, kind of particular to this American context. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist in other countries. It certainly does. But I think there's something about, you know, white supremacy in America that has like fueled this effort to kind of demonize each other, because there are those commonalities, but, you know, the people who are in power don't want us to see that. And I think, you know, in the 60s, I think there was a concerted effort from, you know, public intellectuals and politicians to highlight Asian Americans as a quote unquote model minority. There were various news profiles of Asian American kids that were like high achievers in education that sought to divide Asian Americans from specifically the Black community, right? To uplift Asian Americans as kind of in contrast to the stereotype of the welfare queen. And both of those stereotypes are so damaging, but in very different ways. And I think, you know, a lot of Asian Americans have internalized that narrative that, oh, like, you know, our community is better than the Black community or, you know, the Latinx community even because, you know, we work hard or whatever. They've internalized that because white supremacy has kind of rewarded that thinking. And so it's a lot of work to undo. And I think there are so many great folks within the Asian American community that are doing that, especially with older members of our community or folks who are first generation immigrants who may not have the same language to talk about these issues as young AAPIs do. And so I think we're seeing some of that like intergenerational outreach. I mean, there's been a lot on social media kind of in response to the Black Lives Matter uprisings of younger people putting out translated letters, you know, to their family members or to elders in their community, trying to explain, you know, in their language, why it's so important to build more solidarity across communities instead of being racist towards Black folks.
It's so interesting to me because I grew up in Manhattan. So, you know, there's a large Asian American community in New York City, but specifically in Manhattan. And it was always odd to me how the community was sort of portrayed. And my Asian American classmates, you could feel the pressure that they felt they were under. You know, the rest of us were just out there being teenagers and doing our thing. And, you know, we weren't bad kids or slouches at school, but we definitely did not have the pressure to achieve that my Asian American friends did. And it felt like there was this incredible societal, and I don't mean just from within the Asian American community, I mean our society as a whole, pressure on them to sort of stand up and be this example for all immigrants and all comers to the United States of this is the way to do it right. And I remember feeling badly for them because it was intense.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an experience that so many Asian Americans can relate to, you know, whether they got those messages directly from their family members or not, there is this kind of societal pressure, right? As you describe, that there is this bigger picture and bigger expectation that you're supposed to do a certain thing, achieve at a certain level, right? Deliver a certain result that I think is really toxic and harmful. You know, and some people say like, oh, like, you know, Asian Americans have this model minority myth. Like, is that really a bad thing? But it absolutely is. It absolutely is in the way that it impacts people kind of on that personal level, as you described, but also in the way that it invisibilizes the struggles, the very real struggles that exist in the Asian American community from the folks who are most marginalized, right? Often refugee communities, people who are low income, you know, folks who don't have access to the same resources. And so then this idea that, oh, Asian Americans are all whiz kids who are really good at math prevents that, you know, maybe Southeast Asian refugee child in school from getting any help or attention in the classroom because there's this idea that, oh, if they're Asian, they must be fine, right? And so I think that's part of why it's important for like organizations like mine to focus on equity within the Asian American community too, and to focus on some of those smaller communities or just, you know, lesser kind of paid attention to communities that have a greater need.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I also, as you were speaking, I remembered something that I haven't thought about in a really long time. When I was a kid, my dad worked in refugee resettlement. And he helped resettle a lot of refugees from Vietnam to the heartland of the United States. I mean, I thought that was kind of bizarre at the time. It's like, oh, you're going from Vietnam to Nebraska. Okay, well, that's going to be strange. But I think people don't recognize how many Asian Americans live in the middle of the country and work in chicken processing plants and all of these agricultural industries that are actually feeding us, but they're not doctors, they're not scientists, they're not doing, you know, that there's this real split between what reality is on the one hand for one group of Asian Americans and what reality is on another side for another group of Asian Americans who came here under very different circumstances. And I just started thinking about that and I thought, oh, you know, yes, once again, it is not a monolith and different cultures and people from different countries have had very different experiences of coming here and trying to become part of the fabric of America. And I mean, it just sort of, it feels painful to me because I feel like, oh, you know, we have erased a whole group of people by just smushing them together and looking at them as this one kind of blob of people rather than individuals.
Right.
And that's sad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, I think it is sad in that sense of, you know, invisibilizing parts of our communities that just aren't seen. But, you know, part of the reason why Asian American as an identity and as a term emerged, it was an intentional effort to wield more power, right? And to build more power in American society, right? It was a recognition that we're not going to be able to do it if we are siloing ourselves into our different ethnic communities and was an intentional effort to come together to win, you know, policies and to win fights that would have concrete benefits for Asian Americans across the spectrum, you know, in light of those commonalities. And so I think, you know, part of what's tough about it is that, you know, Asian Americans that are in, you know, middle America or that are not on the coasts, there are just fewer of us here. And, you know, I am a California Asian, as they say. I grew up in Southern California in a very Asian American community. You know, I was surrounded by people who looked like me, which was incredibly formative in my younger years. But coming to the Midwest and doing all of my organizing here, I can see that the infrastructure is just so different. There are fewer organizations that are doing work in the Asian American community. I mean, there are fewer of us here to organize and to reach out to. And so I think that's part of the challenge, you know, especially with refugee communities that may have been resettled in places that are very, very white. There isn't as much of an infrastructure or history of building their political voice in that place. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, my organization, Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, is committed to doing work in other Midwestern states to support other API organizations there that are trying to have a greater impact, because, you know, we don't want to be, you know, on an island in Chicago. We want to be able to build this broader API voice, you know, both at the national scale, but also regionally.
I think it's really important what you just said, because I think that one of the ways in which the existing structure maintains is by siloing people and groups. So I love that Black Lives Matter exists. I mean, not why it exists, but I love that it is there as a voice. And I want to have Black Lives Matter groups working along other groups, right alongside your organization, right alongside feminist organizations, and working with Indigenous groups to advance mutual causes. And I recognize that this is really a challenge for people. And I'm kind of wondering what your organization is doing to make that challenge just a little bit easier, and how you're reaching out to other organizations and how that's going.
Yeah, that is a huge priority of our organization, especially right now, kind of given this political context and the extreme violence that's being inflicted on Black communities, right? There have been so many just individual instances that are horrifying. And, you know, not just George Floyd, but just like recently in Kenosha, Wisconsin, right, in our neighboring state, there have been uprisings over police shooting a Black man in the back, right, multiple times in front of his children. I mean, it's just almost unbelievable, but in a different sense, it's happened so often that it's almost easy to become desensitized to what's going on. And so, you know, as an Asian American organization, right, like, identity is at the forefront of our organization and the community that we build. We have a police accountability working group that our members are a part of that was actually formed because of an instance of police brutality against an Asian American woman in Chicago that was videotaped. And the video came out, I think, in 2013, and that kind of sparked our first involvement around that issue of police accountability. But since then, we have used that working group to build solidarity with and to support Black-led organizations in Chicago. So, you know, right now, what that group of folks within our organization is doing is, you know, advocating for the Civilian Police Accountability Council, or CPAC, which is an effort spearheaded by many Black-led organizations in Chicago, but that also has built this multiracial coalition across the city to pass that effort. We've been a part of, you know, fights at the city level to end the gang database, which we know just targets Black and Brown folks in Chicago completely, you know, indiscriminately, and also has a significant impact on immigrant communities that face negative immigration consequences as a result of being arbitrarily put on this, you know, quote unquote gang database. So we look for those intersections and really look to highlight those areas of commonality and to find that shared stake because, you know, as much as it's important to do solidarity work for the sake of doing solidarity work, I think it's just as important to be clear on why Asian Americans should be fighting for liberation alongside the Black community. That Black folks getting liberation helps Asian Americans find that liberation too. And being kind of explicit about those connections, I think, is vitally important to build relationships that are sustainable long term.
I could not agree more. It's the whole idea of no one is free until everyone is free. And that exactly. is just so important. And it will keep us reaching out to other people, but it also helps us keep our eye on the main goal, which is freedom. And there's so many things that are pulling at us right now, especially right now, that it can be easy to lose track of that main vision. And when we're working in community, it's so much easier for someone to always say, oh yeah, remember, we're doing this for this larger goal, and let's just keep our eyes on that and not get distracted by any petty squabbles that we might have amongst ourselves. It just feels very important to me.
Right.
I want to sort of change direction here a little bit and just bring up something that has bothered me so much, I can't even say, which is that the current occupant of the White House currently refers to COVID-19 with terms that are intended to lay blame for this virus at the door of China and by extension, the Chinese people. And I mean, besides that just being absurd on its face, it really has created problems for people who are in the Asian American community. And I would really love it if you would talk about some of the impact that that's had on this, on your community in the last 6 months, which I think they fly under the radar a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have seen a rise in anti-Asian sentiment, in discrimination, in even physical attacks against Asian Americans across the country because of, you know, the president's language around referring to COVID-19 in those ways. And it's just scary. You know, I think a lot of people are just unsure of, you know, how they're going to be impacted. And that like uncertainty can create a lot of anxiety for folks, right? Like going to the grocery store or wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. I mean, I remember a friend of mine who's Asian American said early on, before there was consensus around wearing face coverings, that Asian Americans would be targeted no matter what. We would either be targeted for wearing a mask or targeted for not wearing a mask. And that my friend had heard these stories of someone who was wearing a mask when many other people weren't and was like shouted at and, you know, accused of carrying the virus. And that on the other hand, they had also heard stories of people being targeted for not wearing masks and saying, you're carrying it. Like, why are you here? Why are you out and about? And those are small examples in the grand scheme of things that could happen. I mean, there was an Asian American family in Texas that was attacked by someone with a knife. And that family included two children, I think, who had to get stitches and, you know, had to go to the hospital as a result. And so there's just like such a wide range of things that are happening, you know, to target Asian Americans. But I think it's this like broad impact of, you know, just fear and uncertainty, which I think just living in a pandemic alone has created, right? Like none of us have done this before. And it's hard. It's hard to adjust and to figure out, you know, how to take care of ourselves. And it's even more challenging when our political leaders are really spurring this kind of violence and racist rhetoric against our community.
Yeah, this is such a stressful time without anything added to it, this would be a stressful time. And that fear of just stepping outside your door and being targeted because of what you look like is something that certainly Black people are well familiar with. And I am hoping that if there is any kind of silver lining to this particular cloud, that it's that this experience might help us see each other's mutual humanity in ways that we may not have been as attuned to before. I can hope.
I think you're completely right about that. And that is, you know, a silver lining, I think. And we have to do work to make sure that people come out of this experience seeing those commonalities and recognizing that humanity in each other. And, you know, one way that we're trying to do that as an organization is we're launching a new bystander intervention training program, because, you know, I think there have been some studies that have shown that, you know, if someone is the target of whether it's verbal harassment or a physical attack, that bystander intervention or bystander support can really help that person process and deal with that experience in a much better way. And so with this rise in anti-Asian racism that we've seen, even while many parts of the country have been under social distancing policies and under lockdown, so to speak, I mean, we're expecting that when society kind of opens up more broadly, that we will see another uptick in these types of incidents. And so we want, you know, community members to be prepared, not just Asian American community members, but also non-Asians. And our hope is that bystander intervention, you don't just need to intervene when you see anti-Asian racism, right? You should intervene when you see any racism. And there are many different ways to intervene. You know, it doesn't just have to be like directly addressing the person who is, you know, harassing or assaulting someone else. And so, you know, we hope that we can equip community members to intervene when they see anti-Black racism or when they see police harassing people or otherwise being violent against folks, and that we can put some of that solidarity into practice, right, with individuals who might feel like they just don't know what to do if they find themselves in that situation.
I think that's amazing, because I think that a lot more people would take action if they knew what action to take. But because they don't, they just get paralyzed, and you can't blame them. This is not something that we're taught to do. So actually training people on, here's what you do, here's how you do it, is going to be incredibly helpful, I think. And I'm really appreciative that you all are doing this. And if it's possible to link to how people can get more information on that, you and I can talk about that afterwards. And I will certainly put anything that is available in the episode notes for this particular show.
That would be great. We are in the process of launching that training program, and so we don't have publicly available trainings yet, but certainly hope to have some in the next couple of months. And, you know, I mean, I would say even that I am that person who doesn't know what to do, who freezes up, you know, if I see something that's not right, right, happening in front of me. And I'm someone who's been in community organizing for, you know, more than 6 years. And so it happens to the best of us, right? And we have these, I mean, physical and emotional reactions to things that we see and experience. And so figuring out how to process, you know, what our bodies and what our minds are telling us, and to channel that into action, I mean, that's an important skill set and set of tools for anybody.
I really appreciate your saying that you still have challenges with it, because I think there's a lot of shame around that. And I just think that that's kind of the first part. We have to let go of the shame and just say, okay, this is something I'm learning. And then this is something I'm going to practice when a circumstance arises that requires action. I will teach myself what to do, and then I'll do it. And if you don't do it perfectly, that's fine. The point is to just keep engaging. So thank you so much for that. So our time is almost at an end, and I would love it if you would give the listeners three simple things that they can do to assist in advancing the causes that you're championing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say first, you know, since we just talked about it, attend one of our bystander intervention trainings once those are launched and ready to go. Those are going to be a great way to, you know, both understand a little bit of the historical context of anti-Asian racism in the United States and to have a really concrete thing that you can do about it. Second, you know, especially for our Chicago listeners, I would ask you to contact your local elected officials and especially your aldermen and demand that they pass a Civilian Police Accountability Council or CPAC. I think in this moment, it's really important for all of us to show up in support of the Black community and to demand real accountability from, you know, our policing systems. And this CPAC effort is one really concrete way to do that. And to move towards a society where police are not as important, where we can shift some of those resources away from policing and into the, you know, resources that we need, things like healthcare and education and jobs programs, things that actually contribute to real safety and justice in our communities. And third, I would say find an organization and get involved. I think this is a really important time for everyone to find their political home. You know, we strive to create that political home for Asian Americans. And, you know, we want to be in it for the long haul and to support people in doing justice work, not just in 2020, but beyond. You know, I think connected to that, like so many organizations are focusing on this critical election. And so, you know, anything that you can do to get out the vote in your community to make sure that we can have different leadership in the White House, I think that, you know, I'm saying that kind of as myself, as Grace, not as the director of organizing at Advancing Justice. But, you know, we know that the current administration has so many negative impacts on APIs and immigrant communities. And so, you know, making sure that our communities are engaged and are voting in this election is really important.
I could not agree more. Thank you so much. Those are really helpful things to do. And I am looking forward to taking that training when it becomes available. So Grace, thank you. This was such an interesting conversation. I'm so glad that we got to talk. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the Chicago community and in the broader community of our country. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Omgari. It was really a pleasure to participate.
Thanks. And to all of you listening, thank you. This time is just bizarre beyond anything any of us could have imagined, but it's very, very important that we pay attention to the disparities in how our system is functioning. And right now, those disparities are so clear. So while it can be easy to feel overwhelmed, just do one thing. Do one thing. Pick one cause that you're going to get involved with and just do one thing for that cause every day, some small, simple action, and build that muscle of activism because that's what we need. We need all of us to be doing the thing that we can do. So take heart from the fact that in community is great strength, and let's keep working towards justice and equity in whatever way we can. Thank you again for listening. I will be back with another episode of Stepping Into Truth very soon. And until then, remember, change starts with story. So keep sharing yours.